Hello and welcome to the Open Systems Media IoT panel discussion, Cybersecurity, It Starts with the Embedded System, Part 2. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator, with today's panelists, Jared Fry from LDRA, Nihir Patel from RTI, Tim Scutt from Wind River, and Jack Smith from Wind Systems. Today's schedule consists of about 50 minutes of panel discussion, leaving 10 minutes at the end of the hour for audience Q&A. Before we begin, I'd like to run down some important features of your viewing console. First is the Enlarge Slides button. This button will maximize the slides to fill your entire screen. The Download Slides button allows you to download and print the slides if you'd like a hard copy to follow along with. The button labeled Forward to a Friend enables you to send an email to someone that will include a registration link to this e-cast so they can also attend. The Ask a Question text box enables you to participate today. You can simply type your question into the box and submit it during the submit it using the Submit button. You can submit questions at any time during the panel discussion. We encourage you to do so early and often while you're in the material and the question's fresh in your mind. We'll address as many of these as we can during the closing Q&A, and if you have a question pertaining to the e-cast operation itself, you could submit those too, and one of our technicians will be happy to respond to you during the e-cast. You'll also notice some resource links located to the left below the sponsor logos and above this information bar. We encourage you to access those links and download those white paper resources because they are good and useful. This and all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. We have an all-star lineup with us today with lots of great information to share. First off is Jared Fry. He is a field application engineer at LDRA. He has vast experience in the development processes, quality, and certification achievement. He leverages all these skills in a consultative role with a variety of clients in the embedded and IoT industry. Nihir Patel is a product manager at RTI with over 11 years of experience in embedded software and distributed systems. Nihir also has real-world experience with certification efforts, and he's recently worked internally and externally to build a small footprint RTOS for IoT, specifically with security in mind. Interested in hearing some about that. Tim Scutt is a solution architect at Wind River. He is focused on security and safety-critical solutions to meet safety and certification objectives. He brings over 20 years of experience to the panel in a number of embedded and IoT software disciplines. Finally, Jack Smith is a Director of Technology and Engineering with Wind Systems. Jack brings over 20 years of experience to the panel in computer and embedded systems architecture. His stints from startups to Intel Corporation have focused on cybersecurity, and Jack has pioneered development and productization of hardware and software solutions for end-to-end IoT security. Welcome, panelists. Let's just jump into our first topic here, which is preparing for security. So what kind of security considerations around hardware and software selection should we worry about during project startup? Architectural considerations like secure boot and updates, maybe secure data stores, maybe authentication mechanisms, or other. How does the embedded system connectivity expose vulnerabilities? Another important point. And what about operating system and other middleware that you might be dealing with on project startup? Let's start with Jared.
All right. Thank you. So I can kind of take a software development perspective on this. And typically when we're talking about looking at security in the software, there's two places where those vulnerabilities start to come into play. The first one is, like you mentioned, how does the connectivity expose vulnerabilities? So looking at what your intended device is and how it's going to be interacted with. That becomes a security analysis of each of those points of interaction and what the potential attacks or malicious items or even accidental problems that could happen that could cause security holes there. And all of that, the feature that's being exposed as well as security around it become requirements to the actual development later on. So through this analysis of the device, and those potential exploitable interfaces, you develop the requirements and security requirements that are going to drive your development later on. As you decompose those things into actual implementation and then testing later on, The other way that we can look at that is vulnerabilities that are going to be introduced once you start implementation. And at this stage, while you're preparing for your software development, you want to have plans in place for how you're going to keep from introducing problems when you do start implementing the actual code. For that, the main driver there is coding standards, and lots of different groups have gone through and looked at common security vulnerabilities, common things that we see people mess up when they're writing source code, and determining, creating a set of standards that you can use during those phases to prevent those. So something like a common weakness enumeration, the CWE group, they have collated these different things, such as, you know, not having or protecting against array bounds being exceeded or buffer overflows, those common things that are used to break the security and then cause issues within certain devices. And then they provide recommendations for how to exclude those. CWE itself is not a coding standard in a traditional sense, but it does provide ways to identify the types of things that you may run into on a security basis while you're writing the code. And so from there, you can look into more traditional standards, something like the CERT standard from the Carnegie Mellon University, or the MISRA coding standard, which recently released addendums to their standard focused on security, and determine what sort of standard you're going to want to apply later on in your development process. So having this known up front, and then maybe also including other types of rules and standards checkings to make the code more maintainable, testable, and readable. So something like complexity analysis, naming conventions, or style guides, all those things are going to help later on when you get to development, but need to be figured out during this planning phase before you get into actually implementing any of your device code.
Okay, great. Thanks. Lots of great information to think about there, from preparing for the requirements and features and what security considerations for each are. Nahir.
Yeah, and so everything Jared said certainly on point, and I'll come actually from a bit of a different angle here. RTI is heavily involved with the Industrial Internet Consortium that puts out a lot of guidance and frameworks like the Industrial Internet Security Framework. And in that framework, really, security starts with your motivation. So what is the motivation for building your either your industrial control system or aerospace and defense system, or maybe some sort of autonomous system? And, you know, some of those could be financial, could be technical, could be moral. Maybe there's a moral aspect there, or could be even something like safety. So we've talked about safety certifications and the importance there. So if I take that last one, for example, and drop it into the autonomous vehicle use case, the autonomous vehicle market views security as an extension of safety. So it's critical for them to address security, not just to protect data, but to protect lives. I'm going to dig into this a little bit more, and then I'll take a step back. So if you have a speedometer in a car, right, it's going to tell you what the speed is. Now, this information isn't particularly sensitive. Anyone with a radar gun standing outside can measure the speed of a car, but you have a central data fusion platform or drive platform for an autonomous vehicle that is relying on accurate data. You can understand that you need some level of authentication or data integrity, but you may not need data encryption for vehicle speed. And that's just a very simple example. It gets vastly more complex beyond what I can describe on my own. You take a step back and you can see how the motivations can define your threat model, and then from there your security model. And you want to take those into account, certainly, as we start assessing what components we would want to include in our system to secure it. So from a DDS perspective, DDS stands for Data Distribution Services. We focus on securing data, so data across a network. And this is just an example of one aspect of a system you'd want to secure. So we focus, again, on the data on the network, so we rely on other aspects to secure your execution environment. So you want to establish a trusted compute base. So now we're getting into where is the developer, the owner of the system, putting their trust. So now digging into components and a little bit more technically, we're looking at, you know, components like TPMs or HSMs for hardware key storage, for secure key storage, and then a trusted chain of boot, which I'm sure is going to be discussed throughout the rest of this presentation. So you'd want to have a trusted kernel, you want to have trusted applications, you want to be able to authenticate applications. And just one example, just real quick to kind of wrap up why that authentication, that trusted compute base is important, is the GPAC in 2015, where two hackers were able to spoof the application and then effectively take control of the CAN bus, right? Now tying this back to our motivations, you know, someone else in charge of your vehicle puts you at risk, so that security now becomes a safety concern. So I just want to tie that back to the motivations.
Okay, great. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and I really liked your thought on motivations define the threat and security model for a variety of applications. It kind of drives back with what Jared was saying about worry about what your features are than the security around it. Jack, you're up. What are your thoughts?
Definitely you want to address security at project startup. We all agree on that. I second Nihir's promotion of the consortium agenda. The frameworks that they have really help you define a well-defined architecture. You want to take that architecture and you want to cover both functional and security requirements. I can't stress it enough because there's a lot of pieces and layers to a secure solution. And the architecture both identifies and helps coordinate those layers. It takes a little time up front, not as much as you'd think, but it helps you apply the development resources in parallel. And overall, a good architecture will accelerate your design time significantly. You need to cover your device, obviously, but you also want to address the deployment side of it, your connectivity-based threats, both with you as the attacker and as the victim. We covered some of that in the first webcast because there were several high-visibility data breaches were caused by connected devices. Once you've got your architecture started, maybe not finalized, but at least started, you should start pursuing the hardware and software selection. You know, you have more than just a shopping list of features. You want to work with those vendors as partners. You want to talk to them and make them earn their value. You want to make sure that their offerings do what you need them to do and that they're proven and easy and that you have the support. You kind of want the proven and easy simply because you don't want to be reinventing the wheel. These things have been done a lot. You want to make sure the layers work well together. If you have a feature in the hardware, you need to make sure it's accessible to the software. If you want to use something in one software layer, like the OS layer, you want to make sure that it is also promoted to the application layer, et cetera. You don't want to have to do that. You want your vendor software support teams to do that. Vendor support is also really important if you're going for certification. If you're going to try to define a crypto boundary for FIPS 140-2, for example, you're going to need some vendor transparency. You're going to need some access to their engineering and engineering detail, basic responsiveness. Lastly, when you get into the nitty-gritty of the hardware, you're going to need some basic functional things depending on your architecture. Most common is a unique hardware ID. Might mean a TPM. Maybe it's a value fused or flashed into some part of the device. Might be a hash. Sometimes you only really need a serial number or a GUID for less secure devices. You might want some hardware offload, things like random number generation, crypto engines, tamper detection, zeroization. Secure boot is a fantastic technology across all the CPU lines. Really does go a long way towards creating that trusted platform. So, and then, you know, basically when you start getting that, get your vendors that understand more than just their own piece, get them to play well with each other, and start to create your whole architecture into your design.
Great. Yeah, thanks, Jack. Makes a lot of sense in terms of hardware considerations. Tamper-proof thing is something that we sometimes don't think about as system solution software vendors, so that's great. Tim, your thoughts.
Hey, thanks. So I'm Tim from Wind River, and we're a software provider for operating systems and middleware, as well as tools for development of embedded systems. And when we look at preparing for security, really what we're finding, especially as we work with our customer bases, is that it's important to start by defining the goals and risks that you have for security. And there's some well-established methodologies out there for helping to define those goals and risks, such as NIST Cybersecurity Framework and the NIST Risk Management Framework. And these generally start out with an exercise where you go through and identify the things that might be attacked in your system, what they call the assets. Once you take a look at that, then you take a look at the threats, potential threats against those assets, and identify what might happen if those threats become real, and turn that into essentially an assessment of the likelihood and the impact of one of those threats actually becoming real and impacting your system. And that results in a metric that you can use for prioritization called the risk metrics. You kind of take a look at the likelihood that that's going to happen, that a threat's going to happen or materialize, the impact that would have on your system and your business, and it gives you the metric that you can use to identify the risk. And the reason that's important to start with is that we all have to make decisions about prioritization of resources, where we're going to invest our time, where we're going to invest the human capital that we have to resolve issues and get things out the door. And having a pretty good idea of what the risks are, what the impacts are, helps to drive the decisions that you make about where to invest and which things are the most important. But after you go through that risk process, then it's important to recognize that it's really difficult to get every aspect of cybersecurity perfect. And there's a lot of best practices out there that you can incorporate from both the hardware and software technology side of things. We've heard some of the examples from a couple of the other guys, as well as the development processes. So when you think about the hardware and software technology solutions, things that help that come from the best practices area are things like secure boot and initialization and protected storage for data at rest, providing privilege isolation so that you can protect against attackers that are looking to exploit other parts of your system, auditing and logging, and secure updates. But also, you know, plan and do preparations for the development processes. And so that includes testing as well as incorporating the security coding standards, as we talked about before. Most of all, prepare for change, because we're seeing it's going to happen.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. So I think there's a lot of great conversation and input around the preparation phase. I want to remind the audience, while we're thinking about that, please ask those questions so you can get the expertise at the Q&A. Let's move on to security during development. As a project starts now, we've presumably heard what you've said, and we've incorporated some of those kinds of things. Now, in the development phase, decisions are made around open source, third-party software, and even on the hardware aspects in terms of what we might require of our vendors to do tamper-proofing or TPMs, et cetera. In addition to how to ensure this in-house software development must be considered, what kinds of tools, techniques, processes can be used to test for security during the development cycle, and how do you consider the impact of your system against any external system so your system is not a threat gateway into a larger system that you're interfacing to? Let's start with Nahir.
Thank you. And actually building a little on what Jared had said previously about identifying your devices and analyzing the interfaces, we definitely recommend, actually, let me take a step back. We're seeing a trend, and this is really kind of coming out of the autonomous vehicle market, but certainly I've seen it applied, maybe not so explicitly in other markets, is prototyping, right? I mean, prototyping and with a path towards production. So building off what Jared was saying about, you know, analyzing your device's interfaces, if you're prototyping, you can start in small chunks and kind of build out your system with assessing security along the way. I know a lot of folks like to get to the proof of concept minus the security, but it's a great opportunity to narrow the scope and effort required for just adding a little bit of security. So there's incremental steps that you can make along the way and kind of infuse security into this prototyping to production kind of concept. Now, with regards to some of the open source or third-party tools and software you'd want to incorporate into your system, certainly there is a place for open source in the prototyping phase. Certainly you want to do low-cost startups, if you will, get something going. But this kind of goes back to the conception of the project, but it's, have a path towards using something that has been vendor approved and certified, that's something that has a commercial backing if you need support or maintenance, if you need to have updates, and that distributes the risk you take on with regards to security.
Great. Thanks a lot, Nahir. We've got Jack next. Jack.
Okay, thank you. In development, when you're trying to maintain security, both implement security and then not defeat security you've implemented, you want to consider setting up your development infrastructure to include security attacks in your regression testing. You want to make sure that once you've solved a problem, you don't then subsequently break it. Obviously, testing should be automated. Security testing isn't trivial, but there are good tools for that, both through static analysis, you didn't break it. There's, that's a very common tool set, a strong capability to be able to do static analysis of code. You want to define your requirements and tackle each of the interaction points. After that, you want to set up audits. You want to be able to review your security, whether it's through pen testing, et cetera. You want to make sure that you're doing that during the development process, not just when you release it to production. If you wait and say, well, we did everything, and now we're going to release it, and you find a vulnerability, it's much harder to fix the later you find it. Number two, don't allow trivial keys or credentials, even during development. It might sound harder, but if your development engineers are logging in with trivial passwords to test their functionality, that will eventually cause a problem. It might be harder initially. They'll adapt. They'll create the tools they need to do. The infrastructure that they need to build for themselves is likely to get reused for production that way. If you have to deal with unique IDs on a board during bring-up testing, that can be a little annoying sometimes. But with your design engineers creating those tools, as opposed to waiting for your production team to do it, you'll have more functionality in those tools. So again, no trivial keys. Keep your credentials strong and secure no matter what. It'll help with your production team. Now, lastly, I'd say, and this is trending towards some new security capabilities in the monitoring tools, but consider promoting some internal state to a reporting layer for security. You basically want to increase the visibility into your internal system for your security and analytics. And that's because new security tools are modeling normal behavior for your system in order to try to flag anomalous behavior. If you can give them more state, more information to be looking at, whether you're looking at something that's algorithmic or a machine learning algorithm or whatnot, if you can give them more state as to what's happening in your system, it can be more effective for you in identifying threats. So I put that in the development phase because it really needs access to some internal things, calls, events, operations, logins. You want to know who's talking to the system. What are your points of interaction? What anomalies are happening? Is a function call automatically correcting its inputs? Well, maybe you want to report that back up to the security layer. Collect that data, get it out to an analytics machine, let that promote it. Because those changes, those methods are changing all the time, and they're getting better. Your attackers are getting better all the time. You want to make sure you're enabling your environment, your security, to get better all the time as well. So,
right. Thank you. Bring up a really interesting point there in terms of a lot of the security analytics pieces are trying to figure out what normal is so they can detect abnormal. And I really like the point about providing more state and thinking about that during the development process. I think that could be a really key point going forward. Tim, your thoughts?
Yeah. So looking at security during development, my first thing is to encourage the adoption of something like a security development lifecycle that really looks at security across all the activities that you do throughout the security design and implementation of your system. Security can be compromised at a lot of different parts of the system. And so looking at it from a holistic perspective, starting with early on assessment of the threats and the requirements that you have for your system, and then progressing through architecture definition that then traces to your requirements, the design and reviews of those design, through implementation and using tools like we heard about with static analysis, as well as some manual code reviews and other activities that help to improve the security of your system during the implementation phase. But also then don't forget the deployment phase and the importance of during the development process, ensuring that you're implementing not only the security in the implementation, but also as that transitions to your deployment through to your customers. And also that involves the security incident response processes so that you can address security as it evolves over time. We all know that security doesn't sit still. So second, I would say development takes time. And typically continues through multiple iterations of a product. So it's important to ensure that your suppliers, whether they're open source or commercial vendors, are keeping security up to date. And to kind of go along with that, ensure that you have a process for incorporating updates securely and verifying them throughout the development process, because you'll need to not only be able to deploy those updates, but also verify that they're robust and secure during that development process. One of the topics that's a favorite today is open source, and there's a lot of reasons that open source is attractive, but as you adopt open source within your projects, and there's lots of reasons to have even hybrid approaches where you have open source and proprietary components, but the key part for open source components are questions like, how will you maintain those open source components over time? Successful products are often in the field for years, and as we've seen just within the last few years, a lot of times security vulnerabilities can pop up well after a product has been fielded. So how do you maintain those components over time? How do you ensure that the initial security of the open source component is appropriate for your implementation, and who's going to monitor for vulnerabilities that are identified in the component and provide updates going forward. In addition, during development, testing for cybersecurity can be a major challenge, and especially true in embedded systems. A lot of the security mechanisms, the technologies that we put in place, like secure boot, are really challenging to do the testing on, because when you want to unroll and go back to your initial conditions for the next test case, it can be a daunting task. It takes a long series of operations, and so that can create latency in your testing, and testing at scale can also be a challenge because you know the need to cover multiple devices, and simulation can help address those challenges. But I would say probably the most important thing for security during development is to really ensure that the basic issues are eliminated. Things like hard-coded passwords, we heard the previous speaker talk about that, debug capabilities left in. There are processes that you need to put into place to make sure that those basic things are taken care of.
Right. Okay, great. Thanks, Tim. Jared.
So From that software perspective, this development phase is really where the groundwork that we laid in the planning stages starts to be realized. We start to implement those features, and around that, the security requirements that we've created around those different features. So, you know, if you've got a feature that's going to require some input from a user, and you're going to have security requirements around that to make sure that you're verifying what that user input was, how that input's going to be used throughout the system, and that you're not allowing malicious data to be passed in by the users. And so as you're implementing these requirements, you're now creating traceability from the requirement to the functionality within the code that implements that requirement. You're also building tests to verify that feature, as well as the security requirements around it, are being implemented correctly. And you end up with this triad of traceability between your requirements and your code and the tests that are going to prove out that aspect of the feature itself, but also the security around it. Adding in something like structural coverage analysis, where you're actually measuring which code has been analyzed during those testing activities, that's going to show you if you have things like unnecessary code. So, you know, maybe some debug functionality or something somebody put in there that doesn't have a reason or doesn't trace back to a particular security or feature requirement, that if put out into a production device, someone could identify it and use that maliciously to execute their own code or to cause problems within that device. So you want to remove that type of code. You may also find deficiencies in requirements or missing tests. So being able to see during your testing activities, especially your requirements-based testing activities, what's actually been executed, becomes a pretty powerful way of making sure that all of those features are protected correctly. On top of those requirements-based tests, there's of course many other testing methodologies you could apply, things like boundary condition testing, robustness testing, or even just using expertise of code or security expertise of the type of data that might be presented to an interface to try to access it and build test cases around that. A real simple example would be if you're taking pointers as a function argument, you might pass in a null pointer just to make sure that that function does not crash when it tries to reference what's in that value. So it's, you know, checking, protecting that data and that the rest of that device by not crashing if improper data is passed to it. During that development process, those developers have access to the coding standard that you identified and laid out during the planning stages, so they can check it. Oftentimes, it's best to have that be automated, so some static checking that will look at the code and present them with the violations, as well as manual checks, peer reviews, that sort of thing against the code can help to identify feature problems or security holes that might have been missed from the other means, and then being able to automate that entire process, so you end up with many tests and a lot of analysis that can be done with tools statically for coding standards and that sort of thing, and being able to build an environment that quickly repeats those tests, verifies that changes that have been made haven't affected, had some downstream effect that breaks some other piece of the code or hurts that security somewhere else.
Okay, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think you just coined a new phrase that may actually stick here. You mentioned triad of traceability. People think of it like test to requirement, but it's really test of requirement to security implication, which I think you heard it here first, audience. I think you're going to hear about things like that next in the coming years in terms of traceability encompassing security with it. Lots of great things to think about. Again, we've got some good questions coming in. Keep them coming, audience. We'll get to them after our last topic here. Going on to the operational phase now. What kinds of things can be done in preparation for launch and the operational phase. We've got a lot of good comments and considerations for, you know, startup development. Now these things are going to be tested. End-to-end testing may focus on feature correctness, obviously, because that's usually what the marketers care about. But what about security testing, penetration testing, burn-in, leveraging an alpha program, and then scale? And then I think one of our Tim maybe mentioned scaling issues. You had to worry about how bringing up thousands of units at once affects the system and attack threat vectors and things like that. Let's start with Jack and your comments on operational phase preparation.
Absolutely, operational phase is very important, largely because it's big. You know, that's where scale happens, and things that happen once or twice in the R&D team need to happen every time on every product that goes out the door. And sometimes they're overlooked by the R&D team and they made the prototypes. Sometimes major security holes get created in that delivery to production. So it's something you want to address pretty early as to what's going to be necessary. Production test at scale, you know, when Tim mentioned secure boot, that becomes a bigger issue than just, hey, I need to program this image into 1,000 boards. Now you have to get a custom image for each board with the unique ID signed for that board. So that affects your production test. It affects your patching mechanism in the cloud. You need a way to patch devices in the field that are signed with the security for that device that's in the field. You don't just get to send technicians around with a USB stick or tell customers to download something from a website. It has to be a much smarter patch mechanism. Rolling back to production tests, does your production test actually test the security? Is it just testing the assembly process, or does it really get in there and make sure that security is working on that device, that your keys aren't zeroized, that you don't have a violation sitting in the background that nobody notices until a breach happens? Those things at scale become much more common, much more complicated. So one thing to do is get your monitoring and your management in place early. I touched on this during development. Try to get your R&D team to help get that in place well before the production. Try to put it, if you're going to do pen testing or auditing, try to have the test cycle also test the monitoring and management cycle to test the remediation of an issue, not just the detection of an issue. You know, get those things done early. And then lastly, or on the secure root of trust, you know, when you're creating a secure device, you have to have a root of trust somewhere. The first layer of security becomes your root of trust. Often that gets changed when you scale. It might move from R&D to production. It might move from in-house to a contract manufacturer or an ODM. You need to understand where that root of trust is. You need to make sure that that vendor, that person, that chief security officer understands how critical that role is in keeping the system protected. Make sure that they've got defined processes around it. Make sure that they understand the implications around what the root of trust involves. So, and lastly, you know, we mentioned this in the last webcast, be careful of over-designing. Security is so prevalent and so talked about. Some people really don't right-size their security. They want everything, and that becomes a cost barrier. It can lead to frustration. It can lead to, in management or in design, it can lead to less functional product because security often hampers usability. So be careful, right-size your design. I'd stretch that all the way back to the architecture discussion. Start with the architecture and make your vendors earn their money.
All right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and it actually harkens back to Tim's risk matrix where you really need to analyze the threat and the likelihood of it and the cost of a breach. Maybe you can help right-size your security that way. Speaking of Tim, you are up next.
Yeah, thanks. And I definitely agree, Kurt. You know, the understanding the risk and the priorities of mitigation across all the things that can affect your product really help focus your energy on the things that make the biggest difference. And that's a really important part of security because we don't have infinite resources. And during the operational phase, when we start transitioning from the development activities for the product to getting ready to launch that product into the market, that's where, you know, as Jack was saying, scale really becomes a big deal. And there's a lot of challenges to scale for embedded devices. You know, we talked about one of them, which is just How do you go from a few isolated devices that you test in your lab environment to the potentially hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of devices that are that you need to be able to test so that you can make sure that your system and your capability is robust when it's fielded. So replication of those test assets is can be a big challenge because embedded devices have unique constraints often, that make them somewhat of a challenge there. There's repeatability potentially issues where you have large test cases and you're trying to get ready for operation. If you discover an issue, can you repeat that issue so that you can determine that you've definitively fixed it? And kind of hand-in-hand with that is automation, accelerating your tempo of being able to scale out and test at scale. And finally, configuring for different scenarios. Let's say you do have a test bed where you can test at scale for thousands and tens of thousands of devices. When you switch scenarios, what does it take to configure to that new scenario? One of the things that we have found with our customers is that simulation can be a great benefit for that, for embedded cybersecurity. In a simulation environment, it gives you the ability to test either cloud-based or on-premise simulation for a single device, scale that to an entire simulated system so that then you can do a lot of your scale testing in environments that are much easier and quicker to repeat and automate. So that's a key part of security during the operational phases. Another part, just as securing your supply chain during development is an important part, securing the supply chain of your devices as they're delivered and put into service is important. And what that means is securing the deployment of a device as it's received by a customer and installed, securing that installation, securing the onboarding of that device to whatever services that it might connect to, monitoring the security. Jack had a great point there about monitoring. And then finally, making sure that you have secure updates and decommissioning. Updates are a really important part of that big picture, and that life cycle needs to be secured for the updates as well as the initial product delivery.
Okay, great. Thanks, Tim. Jared?
Yeah, I definitely agree with the points on automation and simulation. Those are tremendous ways to get kind of a lot of bang for your buck in terms of testing and reuse once you reach this operational phase. Especially like I talked about during the development process, you kind of build up a big pile of tests and then being able to automate and reuse those through the next phase as you're getting ready to deploy or even after, if it, changes need to come in, things are need to be updated or new features added, you can reuse those test assets that you've built up over time to verify that the changes you're making aren't breaking anything everything is still working correctly. If you're updating code, it's very helpful then to be able to perform an analysis and look back at that traceability and see, what requirements of this code that maybe we found a bug in, what requirements does that affect? What tests do we need to repeat to make sure things are working correctly? What tests do we need to add to make sure that we're now verifying the whatever issue we had is being taken care of appropriately? And also what impact does that have in the code? So maybe looking at the coupling of the code you're fixing against other pieces of the system and how that is going to impact everything else based on what changes you're making. And then incorporating and rolling all that back automatically into your larger test set that you're able to run automated through simulators or other test benches.
Especially important once you've fielded the software, I would imagine. So you have to make sure that all that stuff is being, stored, documented, updates, upgrades, or not break other things and all that. So it really makes a difference. Nahir, what are your thoughts on the operational phase security requirements?
Well, the other gentleman made it really easy. I just refer to what they said, but I'll kind of echo some of the key aspects that we look at. Certainly the PKI and cert provisioning is really critical. With regards to securing data, we do rely on PKI to establish shared secrets among participants. So in that regards, having that that trusted compute base again, right, and having your keys and certificate management in place early on is critical. And then with regards to certificate authorities, a lot of them are cloud-based, or you may have to, kind of manage them yourselves. But if you go with a third party, make sure, you understand their auditing processes and, how they handle their vulnerabilities, because that would then directly or indirectly impact your systems. Aside from the initial establishment of trust is really, again, right, the emphasis on security is an evolving beast that you have to continue to, evaluate the security landscape, what updates you need to make to your software, and then be able to securely make those updates. So having, the ability to revoke certs and issue certs securely to update software. So all of that is absolutely the case. From my perspective. Now, there's some more, kind of longer-term outlook trends and technologies that that we're seeing that certainly help with the scaling issue for sure. On the monitoring front, machine learning is growing and becoming very valuable. So you can have machine learning algorithms constantly analyzing your system's networks, establishing what is a normal flow, what is a normal data flow, and then when there is some abnormality, be able to provide some intelligent alert, or even in some cases be so resilient as to thwart off the attack, or I've heard some research around and actually some customers implementing a form of this where you kind of spoof your attacker, and you send them into a bit of a sandbox, and you learn from them, and now your system becomes that much more resilient. Certainly out of the scope of what we provide here at RTI, but we definitely fit in with the data management aspect of it. Kind of another technology that's growing and becoming really popular, I'm sure everyone's heard of blockchain, and this becomes important, and I know Tim was touching on establishing trust in your supply chain and in your deployment model. So this, blockchain is something that's being researched as a way to establish provenance. So as you go up the supply chain, can you trust the individual components? In a deployment scenario, when we start to, we're thinking maybe something that's consumer facing, or even if it's industrial facing or commercial facing, who's responsible for a failure? Who should be held accountable? And it shows how to distribute that risk there in a deployed system. So, it's kind of more futuristic technologies that certainly I think all of our customers and everyone on the line should be aware of and should consider down the line to stay competitive and to stay secure.
Right, and that makes a lot of sense. Okay, great. Well, we have now gone through pre-development and to the operational phase, have lots of information, have some really good questions coming in. We're to the Q&A question part. Audience, you can still ask excellent questions. We've got a lot of them lined up. I want to ask the first one, which is in a couple parts. I'd like Tim and Jack's comments on this. Others can jump in if they'd like, but it's an interesting question. It would be great to go into depth on how to manage security for legacy systems for the purpose of addressing and assessing current vulnerabilities to prevent future issues. Now, the question is, what type of support organization is required to handle security post-market? Let's get some thoughts on Tim and then move to Jack. And again, unfortunately, the questions have to be pretty short, within 30 seconds or so.
Yeah, thanks, Jack. Or thanks, Greg. Yeah, so from a support, from supporting post-market security, there's a couple aspects of that. The first is having an organization that is monitoring the sources of vulnerabilities that or potential vulnerabilities for your system and applying updates as appropriate is a core part of that. We talked about that a little bit in the development side of things and having being able to have a development process that addresses updates. And the second part of that is then a delivery mechanism to ensure that you're securely delivering those updates to the devices so that you can keep them up to date. The FDA in the U.S. recently released some post-market guidance for medical devices that has some pretty strict time frames. And so having the tool support for both the development and the deployment really is critical to being able to meet the timeframes that you're required in the medical device market, but that really is going to apply to many other markets as you're looking at getting updates to market quickly as possible.
I see. Jack, what are your thoughts on that?
Tim covered the monitoring, patching, and using good tools for speed. I would add to that that you really want to occasionally review and audit the system. You know, just because you audited it when you went into production, you might want to re-audit that for connectivity. For understanding what current threats and how they might apply to legacy systems. So an occasional re-audit of the security system would be valuable. And then, as we talked, a couple people mentioned it, the machine learning is a good way to create new behavioral models for the way your system's working. If you can, pull your legacy system and have it start getting instrumentated so that it can provide data towards those behavioral models. You want to pull in the new tool, the new technology to help you maintain your security. So right. That'll raise your awareness.
Yeah, and I suppose this falls on the ops team, right? I mean, that's the organization that has to kind of adopt this post-market, I suppose. I guess let's go to Jared. What are the mitigation and approaches that we can use to manage the device security once an open source component no longer supports the security updates, or how can we avoid this in the design phase? Are there ways we can do testing, static code analysis, and some of the methods that you described in your topics to address that?
The one thing I'll say is I think a few people mentioned it before about, you know, during the initial kind of phases, sometimes open source is nice, and then phasing that out into something that is either purchased and certified or having some kind of security focus and proof around it is going to usually be a better idea. If you're really tied to an open source component and you're no longer getting updates, you'd basically have to then kind of treat it like something that you are developing yourself is how I would see it. You'd have to look at what the interfaces are to that, what the potential security risks are around those things, and then develop those types of testing and analysis of that open source code to give yourself that confidence that you can continue using that open source code within your device.
Got it. Okay, Tim, you got some comments on this as well?
Yeah, actually, you know, while I raised my hand there, I think part of my comments were addressed, but I think one thing to add to that is that, you know, there are long-term support options for commercial support for open source components that can help alleviate some of the issues. But, you know, like he was saying, the real fact is that at some point you potentially have to own the open source baseline if the sources that you have available for support no longer provide it.
Okay. Jack, you have thoughts on this?
Yeah. One other option for open source is if you do choose to use it and you want to support it yourself, you can contribute that back to the community. You get enough people using it, you get enough emphasis on it, other people will contribute as well and keep it maintained.
Okay, sounds good. Nahir, would a dedicated secured hardware be a required piece for an accountable solution of an embedded system such as a connected car?
So I guess for a blanket response, yes. But this goes back to motivations and then how you're architecting your system. There are So without a doubt, hardware security would have to exist somewhere in an embedded system, either industrial control, connected car. But where and how you use it would be kind of the more pertinent question, and that depends on how you've architected your system. If you've isolated components well enough, then maybe your hardware security could form a root of trust or a piece of the chain of trust.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jack, you mentioned something about tamper proofs and things and TPM kinds of stuff. Maybe that also relates to auto?
Absolutely. When you start getting into security certification, or if you want to know if someone's opened the boxes, you really need to have some sort of tamper circuit. Depending on what certification you're going for in automotive, if you're in under the engine, if you're part of the manufacturing, or if you're an aftermarket add-on, it changes what your requirements are in your certification, and that can affect what you're connected to and what you need in the hardware requirements. So, but yes, tamper is a good thing.
Okay, Tim and Jared, there's a question about, is there literature about preparing for security, especially about threat matrix and the likelihood and impact of threats? Tim.
Yeah, you know, so as I mentioned when we were talking about that, one good source is NIST standards. And they can be pretty elaborate, but there are a number of kind of resources that distill that down into something that is more digestible quickly. So the NIST standards are pretty helpful in that regard. Also, common criteria standards can be very helpful when you start looking at things like threat catalogs and understanding what the potential threats you might want to look at are. It's easy to overlook certain threats as you're going through as an individual, but if you have kind of the wisdom of a collective of people that have looked at this for a long period of time that's been captured in something like the Common Criteria Protection Profiles, it can be very helpful to give you a checklist, if you will, of the threats that you may want to consider so that you're sure you've covered all your bases.
All right, that makes sense. Jared, do you have any resources or...
I think an excellent one to use as a resource is the Common Weakness Enumeration, CWE. It's a community-developed list of security vulnerabilities in source code, so common things that pop up in the way people write code that can cause problems, buffer overreads, things like that, pointer mishandling. But it's very comprehensive, and so it lays a great framework, especially during those planning stages, for the types of things you want to make sure that you're taking into account when you're getting into the development of software.
Okay. Nahir?
Yeah, I just want to reemphasize that the Industrial Internet Consortium has some guidance that they put out, and they're actually consistently putting out some more information, and it's freely available on their website. So the Industrial Internet Security Framework is a great starting point for folks who are trying to speak a common language around security within a business or within an industry, and they're maybe cross vendor or across the supply chain. That's also another resource.
Okay, great. Jack, what about focus on embedded systems and Windows CE being used? Is there any kind of best tools available that considers these Windows kinds of environments?
Windows is a double-edged sword. We support a tremendous number of Windows devices ourselves, but Microsoft does a great job with the visibility and with the patching. Unfortunately, Microsoft is also pushing people towards Windows 10, like IoT Core. We now have on our processors. But their support for Windows 7, Windows CE, Windows 8, all these Windows embedded platforms, starting to dwindle. You can see a roadmap with an end-of-life support for those. So they're encouraging people to move to the long-term support branches of Windows 10. We're trying to help enable that, but there is a lot of visibility on, or a lot of availability on, security weaknesses as they exist to all flavors of Windows. So
okay.
Good tools there.
All right, thanks. Wow, lots of great questions. Unfortunately, we've reached the end. If you joined late, I want to draw your attention to some resource links located at the left below the sponsor logos above the speaker names. We encourage you to access those links. More great information. Unfortunately, it does bring us to the end of the panel today. I want to thank our panelists for sharing their insights on cybersecurity embedded in IoT. We at Open Systems, LDRA, RTI, Wind River, and Wind Systems want to thank you for attending and contributing excellent questions today. Lots of great information. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will also be made available there. Open Systems Media events are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. Thank you for attending, and have a great day.